This is a BloomerBoomer.com podcast with host Andy Asher.
Well, hi, everyone. I hope your week is going okay. Now, we have a good one for you today. In fact, it's a topic everyone, especially those of us over 50, and even more so, a topic us guys should know about, because there's a good chance we'll get to know one of these people intimately well someday. Or, on the other hand, what we're talking about here is a doctor, a urologist, to be more specific, who could get to know us intimately well. Why? Well, among a lot of other things, a urologist is the guy or gal who specializes in our reproductive organs, male reproductive organs. Unlike the doc who knows everything about erectile dysfunction, thanks to Viagra, Cialis, and Levitra advertising, all of us know a lot more than we did just 10 years ago. All right, I know this is a titillating topic and jokes are flowing all the time, but it's really interesting and important. So we had a chance to talk with what is really fair to say a renowned expert on male reproduction. He even introduces us to a disease of our penis most of us have never heard of. So all his accomplishments are too numerous to mention here. He's authored dozens of books and papers all about male reproduction. He is professor of urology and chief of the Division of Male Reproductive Medicine at Baylor University. And his name is Dr. Larry Lipschultz. First of all, Dr. Lipschultz, thanks so much for joining us today. And this is a fascinating topic, and you're no better person to ask than you.
Well, thank you.
Well, and let me ask you just right from the very beginning, which I might call a dumb question, but I'll get it out of the way. How much of men's sexual dysfunction is mental, and how much of it is physical?
So when you say sexual dysfunction, are we focusing primarily on erectile dysfunction? Because, you know, you can have problems with rapid ejaculation, with delayed orgasms, with delayed ejaculation. So which one are you really focusing on?
Well, it seems like we hear more about erectile dysfunction and that sort of thing.
Exactly. So if you look at erectile dysfunction, when I was in training, we used to be told that the majority of erectile dysfunction is due to psychological issues, emotional issues. And then as the years went by and scientists unraveled the actual mechanism of erections, it became clear that a lot of things can go wrong. You know, we discovered in the 90s the importance of nitric oxide and how that impacts relaxation of blood flow into the penis and the ensuing erections, and that a lot of things can go wrong. So I would say right now, if you look at pure psychological causes of erectile dysfunction, maybe 10% of what I see. And then the rest we find reasons for. Now, that's not to say that the men who have organic or medical causes for their erectile dysfunction don't have, on top of that, psychological issues, because it's unavoidable when you're dealing with sexual dysfunction. But as a sole cause, I think it's way, way down on the list of incidences.
So I got out of the way the question of whether erectile dysfunction is emotional or physical or mental or physical. So the next one I want to get out of the way with is there a level of embarrassment for patients to come and see you?
So I'm not embarrassed by any question. And, you know, and by the time the patients make it to my office, I don't think they're embarrassed or they wouldn't make the appointment. I think the people who are so embarrassed that they're immobilized don't ever come in. I mean, so in terms of embarrassing questions, I don't know. I guess the man who has rapid ejaculation might be embarrassed to admit it, or the man who has no orgasm may be embarrassed. But I think embarrassed is the wrong word. I think self-conscious. But we're dealing with a society who's been desensitized by television and the internet. I mean, so I think people's level of embarrassment from the time when I was in training has significantly dropped. I just don't think they're embarrassed.
And
they may feel awkward, but I don't think they're embarrassed.
So what I hear you saying is nothing is too embarrassing.
Exactly. And there's nothing they're going to tell me that I haven't already heard.
Well, that's reassuring.
So, you know, and so people tend to you know, feel better when they know that they're not alone, which might be a benefit of the internet, you know, and those chat rooms where people get to find people who have their same problem. The downside is they find answers that are wrong, and that's bad because they come in with preconceived ideas of what is going to be their treatment, and it's often way off base. So, you know, it's the joy and the frustration of the internet,
and also television, because we see so many ads for Cialis and all of the other medications. And I would
exactly.
And is that giving an accurate depiction of what's out there and what the potential help is, or what does that do? It must somehow skew things a little bit.
No, and I don't think it skews. I think what it does is it gives people a sense of it's okay to talk about this because I saw it on television. If I could see it on television, and if my kids are watching it, then certainly I can talk to a doctor about it. So I think, it number one, it gives them a permission to talk about it. Secondly, it gives them hope that there's something that can be done for their problem. And thirdly, I think it gives them a sense of assurance that there's a lot of other people with my same problem where they wouldn't be advertising on television.
Okay, so Dr. Lipschultz, I have to ask you this. What's the difference, let's say, between erectile dysfunction and in the case of some guy who might just have a few off nights? I mean, they're just not ready to perform.
That's a good question. I think the question really is, do people sometimes get overly concerned about the occasional inability to have an erection and come in thinking they have D when they've just had a situational issue where they were tired or they had too much to drink, but they don't have an ongoing problem? So those people need reassurance. Now that's in contrast to the patient who over 50% of the time does not have a satisfactory erection or completion of intercourse. So that would be a patient who has, you know, serious or significant ED.
Okay, and then just based on what we see on television in terms of the advertising and knowing the kind of money that it costs to put those ads up there, one would be led to believe it's pretty common.
It is very common. I mean, erectile dysfunction of some sort is very, very common. I mean, I don't remember exactly the statistics. The Massachusetts Male Aging Study, which is a very large database of patients who were followed for many, many years in the New England area, found that at some point in time, it was, I believe, over 50% of the people had erectile dysfunction of one sort or another.
Okay, and are medications like that the only treatment, or are there other solutions?
No. So when you talk about treatment of erectile dysfunction, I think it's best to think of it in terms of levels, level one, level two, level three. And this has been well delineated by the American Urologic Association. So level one treatment would be pills. So you go to the doctor, you establish that you do have indeed erectile dysfunction worthy of therapy. So we're going to start level one treatment. We're going to give you several different samples of pills or several different prescriptions, because not all pills are the same. And if one may work and one may not work. So let's find out what pill works for you, if any. Okay, that's level one treatment. Level two treatment would be things like there's a little medicated pellet that can be inserted into the tip of the penis, which gives a medication that spreads from the inside of the penis, which is the urethra, the tube which you urinate through, into the erectile tissue. And that medication, which is called prostaglandin E1, can help some men get an erection. That's level two treatment, as is the use of a vacuum erection device.
Okay, so and then it goes from there up to level four, I think you said?
Level three treatment would be learning how to inject your penis with a medication to cause erections, which is universally successful for patients. And, you know, eventually their problems be it circulation or neurological, can get too great for even that to treat. And then lastly, we have the penile prosthesis, which will always work. So those are your four levels of treatment.
Okay, and I guess we should probably touch upon, there are certain illnesses, I suppose, that cause or have an effect on one's ability to have an erection. Is that correct? What might some of those be that someone should be might be aware of?
Certainly diabetes, both type 1 and type 2, low testosterone, spinal cord injury, multiple sclerosis, all the neurological disorders can affect your ability to get an erection. Trauma, some type of pelvic injury to a young man that interferes with his arteries, that go the pudendal artery that goes to the penis. Peyronie's disease, scarring of the penis, which causes not only an angulated penis, but also the veins that are supposed to clamp down and trap the blood so that the blood accumulates and one gets an erection become incompetent and the blood leaks out. That's called a venous leak, and that's a cause of erectile dysfunction.
Now, typically, are your patients a certain age, or does it just run the gamut?
I think it runs the gamut from 40 till 70 or 80. And another major thing we're seeing now is people who've had prostate cancer surgery. So, you know, they will at some point have problems with erections immediately after surgery, sometimes lasting longer. And we have a whole scheme that we use, an algorithm for addressing these patients.
So we hear some of the side effects on the TV commercials of the medication. I don't know if there are any other side effects, or you want to just expand upon that. I mean, they talk about the 4-hour erection and things like that. Is there anything else?
On the pills?
On the pills, yeah. I mean, that's what we hear.
So, you know, and the reason, there's twofold reasons why you hear this on television. Onefold is that according to FDA guidelines, if you run a commercial, you have to give, it has to be fair balanced. So you have to give the positive side of your medical treatment and your negative side of your medical treatment for that particular drug. And you hear that for all the drugs that are advertised on television. So the pharmaceutical company has elected to mention the 4-hour erection as part of the negative side effect. However, it's been my experience that a lot of patients, when they hear this, think of it as a positive attribute.
That's right.
Goodness, I can get a 4-hour erection. This sounds great. So, you know, you got to consider the context of the patient hearing this. In reality, I don't think I've personally ever seen any patient who's taking a pill that's lasted for 4 hours, where the results have lasted for 4 hours. So, I don't know where that came from, and I think it's kind of a double-edged sword when it's presented as part of a commercial. Now, the injection therapy, you have to be very careful of. That can last more than 4 hours. And I actually give my patients a little plastic-covered card to keep in their wallet, so if they do use injection therapy and if they do have an erection that lasts too long, they can go to the emergency room and give this to the doctor, and they'll give him instructions on what to do.
Now, you hear that even in the pornographic industry, they use these sort of things. Is there any truth to that?
It's 100% true.
Okay.
I've been called by some of these guys to ask about treatment for injection therapy and for the pills. They use both. Certainly, they'd rather use a pill.
Yeah. Any risk factors for ED at all? Common risk factors? I guess you talked about that a moment ago.
You know, diabetes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, hypertension, elevated cholesterol, cardiovascular disease. Anything that can affect the blood flow to the penis can have an effect on your erection. So, again, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, even after it's been treated, it could leave its mark on the blood vessel.
And something that we wanted to talk about today was Peyronie's disease. So maybe you can just talk the very basics, what it is, and then...
Sure, and I think it's very, very appropriate to tie it in with erectile dysfunction, because that's, you know, a big problem for these patients. So Peyronie's disease is a scar on the penis that causes the penis to angle, to angulate, because that scar area will not expand during erection, and it torques the penis up or to the side, wherever that plaque can be. Sometimes these plaques are calcified. Sometimes they're readily identifiable. Sometimes they're subtle. It's not understood entirely why people get it. We know that a subset of men will be having sex, will suddenly have their penis bent, this traumatic bending of the penis can initiate the scarring process, also known as fibrosis, which results in a penile scar or plaque, which is Peyronie's disease. There's also a genetic component to it, in that fathers with Peyronie's disease have a higher incidence of having sons with Peyronie's disease. So Peyronie's disease is a scar in the penis that causes painful angulation that can prevent intercourse, and also be associated in some time with erectile dysfunction.
And how that scar comes about is still unknown?
Well, it's due to trauma. That's one etiology. It can be done following the use of a catheter, or following cystoscopy, anything in which the inside of the penis or the urethra, the urinary tube, is irritated. That's a less common cause. And then, of course, idiopathic, undefined, which may be related back to a genetic etiology. In fact, our laboratory is now looking at genetic causes of Peyronie's disease, trying to understand better which men are at high risk to get it.
And I guess that can affect a man of any age.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it in men in their 20s. I think the most common age is over 40, but I've seen it in men in their 20s and 30s.
And if you haven't already explained, what is the treatment for that again?
So what I like to do initially, so there's two phases of Peyronie's disease, the acute phase and the chronic phase. The acute phase is when the patient first notices that it's usually associated with discomfort. At this point, I'm starting these people on medications to decrease the biochemical substances in the penis that are related to scarring, and we try to get through the acute phase of the disease, and then it becomes chronic, where they're left with this angulation, or sometimes a narrowing of the penis called a waist. And at that point, we like introducing more definitive therapy. And fortunately, about a year ago, the FDA approved the first treatment for Peyronie's disease, which is called Xiaflex. And it's a very tiny injection of something called collagenase into the scar, into the plaque. And it's done in four treatment cycles. And the data from the package insert based on our study of the drug showed that there's an average of a 30% improvement in that angle based on that injection therapy. So we're very excited about that, and we're continuing to see increasing numbers of patients who do have that problem.
And then just back to the general topic of erectile dysfunction, any advice for the partners of men living with ED or PD?
Well, I mean, I think advice to the partners would be to get them in, to make them realize this is not an embarrassing situation. For the couple's sexual and interpersonal health, he needs to be treated. And I would really recommend that the woman, the wife, the partner, go with the man to this visit. It's not a man doesn't function as in a vacuum. He does have a partner. And if that partner is involved and understands the treatment, I think it's much better for the couple, for the man. And I think we know that it does increase the success of the outcome if the woman's involved from the very beginning.
So, Dr. Lipschultz, I guess it should be pointed out that for someone who has ED, it could be an indicator of some other condition or issue going on in the body.
Of course, because it's a circulatory problem for the most part, and we do know that men with ED who do have problems related to circulation, this may be a harbinger of as yet unidentified cardiovascular disease. The blood vessel to the penis is smaller than the coronary vessel. So if I see a young man with erectile dysfunction with who doesn't have any risk factors, and I'm concerned, I do send him to the cardiologist for a stress test.
And how things have changed. I mean, up until just 10 years ago, erectile dysfunction was a secretive thing. And boy, has it sure changed.
Exactly. I mean, I think we have to give acknowledgement to the fact that in 1998, with the advent of Viagra, people began talking about erectile dysfunction in a public forum for the first time. And I think it's just gotten better since then as more drugs have come along and people have become more comfortable, men in particular, about discussing what you identified initially as a somewhat embarrassing situation.
And then there's what we were talking about a little bit earlier before we actually started recording about how the trend or tendency is to actually have doctors who specialize in a specific sex or gender.
I mean, just the whole area of gender-specific medicine that I think is increasing in terms of, you know, identifying diseases that are unique to either the man or the woman and seeking out physicians who are comfortable with that. And not to forget that men do have serious problems with testosterone deficiency and infertility that, again, should not be embarrassed to discuss and find a physician who can help you with that, because by working with somebody who is comfortable with the area, the patients are going to get the fastest response.
And with that, Dr. Lipschultz, I thank you for your time, and I know for one, I learned a lot.
Yeah, and thanks for talking with me.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to our BloomerBoomer.com podcast. We provide transcripts for most of our podcasts, and you can also access all of our podcasts on iTunes. Oh, and we encourage you to leave a comment in the podcast reply section.